Welcome back to the Final Four is not on the schedule. He is Rod, I am Cameron, and Michigan State wins again against number 22 ranked UConn, 64-60. Rod, and this was something. This was a really gritty performance, really pressure-filled free throws down the line that they hit. But they get out to another good start in this one, 9-2 right out of the gate there. And then sort of give that lead a little bit away, come into halftime with an 8-point margin, and UConn kind of storms back. And MSU at one point down 13 or 14, I believe.
No. It never got that bad, but they were I want to say that the highest margin was 9.
9? Okay.
I don't think they got it into double digits. And most importantly, it was 7 with under 5 minutes to play.
Right. And that's where you get worried there. It was 7.
Sure.
And and then Gabe comes down, hits a 3, and they kind of claw their way back with free throws and defense, really. I mean, that's a 9-0 run to finish that off. A great win. I mean –
well,
what was your
I'm gonna add something to that. Yes, they hit some big free throws, but they don't win that game without A.J. Hogard.
Mm-hmm.
A.J. Hogard made 2 fantastic plays for Julius Marble. One was a wraparound pass, and the other was a transition feed to Julius in stride, which – honestly,
that was
a 99th percentile play. That it was you could criticize him for taking the risk, but he made the play. I mean, it was pinpoint accuracy, and it was a high degree of difficulty. And then, of course, he hit free throws, drained them both, and that's not a given with AJ
mm-hmm.
on a controversial foul call that really played both ways, because not only did it give MSU that opportunity to score with the 2 free throws, but it also took Cole out of the game, which I think played into, in a couple different ways, played into the way things went after that for UConn down the stretch. For one, they didn't have their point guard in those huge possessions late, those last couple possessions. They didn't have their point guard. And you saw what happened. You know, Gaffney got the ball taken away from him by Malik Hall, which was a massive defensive play. But it really wasn't – it's the kind of play that your starting point guard probably doesn't make. It was just kind of an unfocused error. And then the other thing, which I think really also played into things just before that play by Malik, was Danny Hurley lost his mind. There's certain – look, when there's a bad call, I get it. You need to let the officials know. If for no other reason than because it was going to be UConn's ball after that stoppage and play, you want to maybe give yourself a chance to lobby for a makeup call or, you know, whatever, that you're going to get the benefit of the doubt if there's contact. So I get going at the officials a little bit. I'm not a believer in the stoicism thing necessarily. If that fits your personality, fine. But there's a place for going after the officials for a second after that call. But he lost his mind. Any other circumstance in a game, he would have been teed up. Any other time, any other score, he would have gotten a tee. I give the officials credit for showing the restraint to not tee him up because he was insane. And I think when they called timeout, they're calling timeout to go into a play to try to get the lead back, right? They're down mm-hmm. 1, I think, after AJ's free throws. He spent half that timeout jawing at the officials, not even in his own huddle. So you can question. I mean, there was a mistake made by Gaffney, for sure, throwing the ball, you know, kind of lazily where Malik was able to stay tall and intercept it. But man, you, as a coach, you got to keep it together. Those are big possessions, right? I mean, that's what I thought. I understand him being upset because it was a questionable call, let's be honest. or sure looked that way, every angle I saw. The only thing I would say is anytime you reach across an offensive player's body, you are taking a risk. And that is what happened. I mean, any coach going back to when you're in junior high will tell you that. If you reach, you run the risk of somebody calling it, even if you don't touch the guy. But okay, we can all agree it was, at the very least, a questionable call. But come on, there's still a game to be played. There's still a possession to be won. You're out there losing your mind like a maniac for half the time out. That's not helping your team. So I admire the passion, but, man, that was not a good close to the game. I've talked about this before. I have a brother-in-law who played D3 basketball at Williams, but he grew up in Connecticut. He's a huge Connecticut fan. Mm-hmm. And that was his commentary to me after the game, and I agreed with him. Like he thought Hurley really cost them down the stretch. You know?
Yeah, I mean, if you're a Connecticut fan, you have to feel like you gave that one away, probably.
To some extent, but I will say this. I think Michigan State also took it. You know?
Yeah.
I just mentioned, you know, you talked about the free throws, and yeah, that's true. They hit the free throws. But man, AJ Hogard and Julius Marble were large down the stretch of that game. Those guys went out and made high percentage plays. That one in transition that I already went through, AJ making it like a 99% pass, also should give credit to Julius Marble for being able to catch it.
Yeah.
And go up fluidly into a layup. I mean, that's not easy at all. So those guys, I don't want to say that UConn kicked it away. UConn made some mistakes, to be sure, but Michigan State also went out and made play after play after play. You know,
and
so it goes both
Marble's,
ways.
Marble's defense at the end of that game on Sanogo, you know, he kept him off his spot. You know, like he was able to get Bingham back, Bingham down a little bit further than Bingham would have wanted, but he wasn't able to get that on Bingham or on Marble, which pushed him out maybe 2 or 3 feet more than he was comfortable with, and he was missing them.
I could not agree with you more. I think this was the best game in totality that I've seen Julius Marble play.
Yeah.
He's had games where he scored like this before in this area. I've never seen a defensive effort out of him. Here's a stat for you. There was a point fairly late in that game where Sanogo was 7 for 13 from the floor. And I'm pretty sure it was just after that Markey went to the bench and Julius came in.
Mm-hmm.
Sanogo finished 1 for his last 5 from the floor. And you're exactly right as to why. That's the first time I can really remember, like for a sustained period of time, Julius Marble's strength showing up defensively like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're exactly right. The key was he moved that kid just off the spots he wanted to be in. And that was enough.
Yeah.
That was enough. Because Sanogo had a hell of a game. I mean, I do think Markey, particularly in the first half, I thought Markey played pretty well against him.
Mm.
Markey didn't get any shot blocks in this game, but he altered a lot of stuff from Sanogo. Sanogo was struggling in the first half. And then in the second half, I felt like for the first 15 minutes or so, he kind of solved Markey a little bit, got himself to the spots he wanted to be in, got into shot motion quickly. So Mark didn't have a chance to let his length really play the way it did in the first half. But, yeah, Julius Marble changed the game, both ends.
Yeah. And it also hurt them not having Whaley, which, I mean, you'd have to think is a little bit of a byproduct of them not being able to close out Auburn earlier.
Yep, possibly. And, you know, here's the other thing, too. We talk about that down the stretch. You were kind of waiting to see if the effects of that double overtime showed up on their legs, you know, and their decision-making. And it took a while, but you could also maybe assume that that may have played a role in how the stretch run went for both teams. That Michigan State was just a little fresher and UConn was just going to be a little more mistake prone. It was a loss to lose that kid, but he's not a huge producer for them. And you know, UConn's got a lot of depth too, so mm-hmm. yeah. I don't make a whole hell of a lot out of that.
Yeah. You know, the other one that really shone in this one, Gabe Brown, man, 32 minutes, 16 points, 10 rebounds, 7 for 13, hit 2 of 3 threes. Huge game for him.
That part of it, the rebounding, was what I was most impressed by. I mean, the shot making was big too, obviously, although, boy, Connecticut really clamped down on him in the second half. He got that big one late to kind of help spark the comeback, as you mentioned. But the 10 rebounds, man, Gabe, sometimes he looked like he was shot out of a cannon. And,
yeah.
And he had to be, and Michigan State had to be, because that UConn team, Danny, one thing that's not bullshit is that from what I've seen now, watching them twice this year, is that Danny Hurley is getting that program back to its essence, its DNA, under Jim Calhoun. The only thing they're missing is they don't have that 7-foot guy that they so often had. You know, they kind of came in right behind John Thompson's Georgetown program and assumed the mantle of Big East program that always seems to have a 7-foot kid from Africa
mm-hmm.
on the roster. They had a lot of them. But they don't have that, but you know, the kid that with the length, the way that Sonogo plays, and just the length and athleticism that whole team has, I'm not sure that they miss it. For forever, like long before shot blocking came into vogue because of rule changes, UConn was a program that defensively relied a lot on shot blocking. You can go back to guys like Okafor and, you know, Sabit. They had tons of them, yeah. And boy, this was a tremendous performance. We talked in the pregame that these teams were both right at the top in shot block percentage. Well, today it was all one-sided. 13 blocks for UConn, 1 for Michigan State.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think that's slightly deceptive in the sense that, as I mentioned, Markey didn't get credit for any. But he absolutely affected shots and altered shots. But even considering that, man, UConn, that is for real. And I thought they attacked the boards. You know,
mm-hmm.
Michigan State actually won the rebounding battle here slightly, which is impressive. And it required an effort like the one Gabe Brown and other guys gave. But Gabe was tremendous on the boards. And, yeah, it's nice to see that jumper start to get dialed in again.
Mm-hmm.
This is two straight games that – they've shot the ball well as a team from deep. They're selective. They're not taking a ton. They only took 14 of them today, you know, and they didn't take a ton of them against Loyola. But if that's going to be the case, what that tells me is they're being selective about it, and maybe shot selection is helping that percentage improve. Because if you look at the stats, honestly, the difference in this game is three-point shooting. It's so even. They both had exactly the same number from the floor. They were each, I believe, 23 for 64, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
23 for 64. But you know what the difference was? Oh, and they both also hit 12 free throws. MSU was 12 for 19. UConn 12 for 17. The difference? UConn was 2 for 16 from 3. Michigan State was 6 for 13.
Mm-hmm.
There's your game. 4 points.
And
4 points from 3.
And that's, I almost, it's, you have to almost bring up Hauser. He finally hits it 2 for 4 from 3. And
well,
that's a
two straight games,
you know?
And by the way, the two misses that he had were both great shots and they were in and out. And I've got no problem with him taking them. And that's two straight games that I think, for the most part, Joey is playing the way he has to. You know,
yeah.
He also, for the second straight game, chipped in on the glass. He had six
boards.
Four.
Yeah.
Yep. You know, 19 minutes. That's solid basketball from Joey Hauser. I'm happy with what they got out of him.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, and again, part of the rebounding effort. The one area UConn got them is UConn made more of their offensive rebounding opportunities. They actually got out-rebounded on the offensive glass 15-12. But, so that means Michigan State was a decently better percentage in terms of their offensive rebounding rate. But UConn turned theirs into 15 second chance points, MSU only 4. And that tracks with what, anecdotally, just watching the game, it felt like. It felt like UConn was just flying to the offensive glass. And a lot of tip-ins, put-back dunks. There was just a lot of activity around the rim, whereas Michigan State's offensive rebounds were not very productive from a point-scoring point of view. You know, it just felt different. But that said, you know, Michigan State, they gave up 12 offensive rebounds. With the activity level UConn had, if they weren't competing the way they were, it could have been a lot worse.
Yeah.
So I do think MSU and, you know, Gabe and Joey, both a big part of that. Markey, too.
Yep. Markey had 7 rebounds, 7 points. But it looked like he was pressing a little bit with some of the shots. Too many fadeaways.
I would agree. Yeah, exactly. Look, the bottom line is, even if he misses on a jump hook, that's still the shot I want to see from him the majority of the time.
Yeah.
If he's got an open jumper from, you know, 15 to 18 feet, I'm fine with him taking that. He's shown he can hit it. But the fadeaway, let's get that out of the repertoire. I just don't think that's a high percentage shot. And I get it. Sonogo was really giving him and everybody else trouble. The kid had 6 blocks. We know from the way Markey's impacted games what that can do to an opponent, right?
Mm-hmm.
Gets in your head. But the solution is not fading away. The solution is, hey, you're 7'1 with a 7'4 wingspan. I don't care how good a shot blocker that kid is. You can go over him. And if you go up straight with a jump hook, there's not a damn thing he can do to block it. I'm telling you. So, look, Markey still contributed. But this was the least impactful game we've seen from him in a while. That's not to say it wasn't impactful. I still think he played well. It's just, you mentioned, you know, offensively, I think he got a little bit outside of himself at times in the second half especially. And, you know, for as much as he disrupted the game still with his length, to not have any shot blocks, well, that's unusual. We're getting very used to, you know, 4, 5, 6 a night, right?
Yeah.
He didn't come up with any.
Yep. And then Malik Hall, 28 minutes, 2 points, 4 rebounds, 3 assists, but 0-for-5 from the floor tonight.
Yeah, he just, you know, look, I had this discussion with somebody on the Spartan Mag board after yesterday. I had reiterated a point I made here on our podcast that his game against Loyola to me looked like the ultra efficient version of Aaron Henry. And we said, okay, this is 2 straight big games in a row for Malik. Can he continue with this? And, you know, my feeling is he has found a new level of play. I still feel that way after today. Mm-hmm. But he obviously didn't score. I liked the shots he was getting. I thought he, as much as anybody else, he, 2 guys, Malik Hall and Max Christie, I thought really got affected by UConn's length. I think there were plays both of those guys had around the basket that against the vast majority of other opponents, they're finishing. And they weren't able to finish them today. Michigan State missed a lot around the rim. And that was, you know, give credit to UConn, man. They're long and they're active.
Yeah.
And I think that made it hard on Malik finishing. But, again, say what you want. You show up late. You stand tall. You make that defensive play. And then you go down and you hit free throws, turn a 1-point game into a 3-point game. That matters.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
I take note of that. Guys who step up when your team needs a play made, he did.
Yep. And then Tyson Walker, 26 minutes, 6 points, a rebound, 3 assists. He hit a 3-pointer, a couple turnovers.
You know, he's another guy that I think got impacted a little bit by the length at times. But, despite the way this game happened to unfold, my perspective on things has not changed.
Tyson Walker is the guy who could better execute half-court offense. And as long as he's aggressive, and I thought he was decently aggressive in this game, as long as he does that, Michigan State's going to benefit from it.
Mm.
Not as strong a game as against Loyola, but I like the fact that he hit another three. You know, him continuing to do that should do nothing but improve his confidence. MSU just needs more out of him. And look, they're going to need more out of him if they're going to beat Baylor tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
There's no doubt about that.
And then Hogard, 18 minutes, 5 points, a rebound, 5 assists tonight for Hogard, and only 1 turnover.
Look, I've everybody listening to this knows where I'm at with AJ. I do think what has shown to be the case clearly so far this year is if Michigan State is in an up-and-down game, if they're in transition, A.J. Hogard can be really effective because that's where he thrives. In the half court, I will not pretend otherwise. When Michigan State had that lineup with under 5 minutes to go and they're down 7 and A.J. Hogard was running point, I was losing my mind. Now, there's no question that it was the right move. And that's why, you know, one guy – earns millions of dollars to coach this team, and the other guy is sitting here talking on a podcast. A.J. Hogard was the difference in that game at winning time because he stepped up. He was solid defensively, didn't get taken advantage of. He made 2 fantastic plays, as we've talked about already, for Julius Marble, and then he stepped up in a huge situation and drained 2 free throws to put MSU back in the lead, and they never relinquished it after that. I give credit where it's due, man. He had really struggled. And I think for most of that game, you did see, I mean, what was he, 1 for 5 from the floor, 1 for 4 from the floor. And 2 of those misses were at the rim. And they're plays that I know people got excited by the way he played in the Kansas game. And against MAC opponents, he can do it too. But I think AJ and his, you know, looking to attack the rim and create opportunities for himself doing that, I think that plays well against smaller opponents. But if you look at the games where Michigan State has played bigger teams or at least teams that are more experienced and stronger, which I would even include Butler in that, but definitely Loyola, and of course today UConn with all that length and experience, it hasn't played as well. And I don't think that's an accident, and I think, unfortunately, I think that's probably a preview of what Big Ten is going to be like. I'm not saying he can never be effective doing that, but it's going to be more challenging than you've seen in his better moments as they move forward into conference play. I'm pretty convinced of that. And he doesn't have a reliable jumper to fall back on. You know, that's the other problem, is you don't want to really see him taking jumpers. At least I don't. But, hey, today, absolutely a difference maker at winning time. Give him his due. He was great.
You know, and it's a little bit of a chicken and an egg thing with him because sometimes it feels like there's these moments and time periods of stagnation in the offense where you kind of like his aggressiveness because it's like somebody's got to do something. But
well,
is that because that he's running the point and that's why?
There you go. That would be that would be my argument. I think that's my problem is that I think the half court offense when he's running it too often stagnates that way because you know. MSU doesn't want him to shoot a jumper. The opponents know that, too. So that's going to impact. In fact, I've been surprised teams haven't been playing off him more than we've seen because that's what I would do. I would make him prove that he can beat you with a jumper, you know, kind of the same way they used to defend Tom. But I do think he's just his feel for the position is not great in terms of running half-court offense. That's my feeling. That said, every once in a while, he has moments, and they're moments. They're not consistently, but he has moments
where he makes me think, maybe there's a chance that somewhere in there, there's a guy who could be a little more consistent with it. Example today, the wraparound pass he made to Marble, which came the bucket before the transition basket. I think you're right. I think part of the reason there's stagnation in the first place is AJ's out there running it.
Mm-hmm. And then Jaden Akins, 9 minutes, 2 rebounds, 0-for-2 from the floor, and a steal.
Yeah, not a game where the opportunity was really there for Jaden. I think this was interesting, though, and it'll lead into Pierre Brooks, who really had his first meaningful minutes of the season late in the first half.
Yeah.
That they went with Pierre instead of Jaden, and I think that was because Jaden and Max both really struggled in this game. They looked like freshmen. They just were never really in it.
Mm-hmm.
I think in Max's case, maybe the length and the strength of UConn kind of surprised him. Jaden just never, to me, seemed in the flow offensively. But, boy, they give Pierre Brooks his first chance at real minutes. And it was brief, but he made his impact. He did have a turnover on a bad decision, trying to kick the ball back through traffic. But he didn't hesitate on those two shots, and one of which was a three. And I'm telling you, keep your eye on him, because Pierre Brooks, offensively, I don't think that's any kind of fluke. I think he can play offensively right now for Michigan State, because I felt that way about him as a high school player. Offensively, he's got game that can translate right now. The question is, can he make enough strides defensively to earn Izzo's trust? I mentioned this on the message board earlier today. I think it was this morning. Maybe it was even yesterday evening. What's coming up right now, Michigan State, if you look at their schedule, once they get past the middle or into the middle of December, it really opens up. They've got two stretches. I want to say between like the 13th and the 29th, I think they play twice, maybe even just once.
They don't play anything from the 21st until the 29th.
Right. And then there's another stretch, I know, because I'm going on vacation from the 15th through the 19th, and they're not playing during that stretch either. So there's going to be an opportunity for this team to get better and for some individuals to make strides. And when you look at guys like Draymond Green and Xavier Tillman, whom I mentioned in connection with Pierre Brooks before, that, as I understand it, was the period where those guys started to make their move. And it doesn't mean that right out of the chute in the beginning of January they were there, but it's where it started. And then eventually, as Big Ten play wore on, they got themselves to a spot where they forced Izzo's hand, and he had to play him. I think that is possible for Pierre Brooks this year. They don't need a ton out of him, but, man, if they could get even, you know, 7 or 8 good minutes out of him a night, it changes the dynamic considerably.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because of the way things were going with Max and Jaden, you also saw Michigan State going to the 2-point guard lineup more frequently today, I thought.
Yeah.
Hogard and Walker were out there together more often than we've seen. That's okay, but I don't think that's ideal.
Mm-hmm.
I would much rather, if he's able to hold it together on the defensive end, I would like to see somebody like Pierre Brooks getting those minutes. And so I think what he can do in terms of conditioning improvement and defensive improvement is going to be what tells the story. Can he start to force his way into a role? And I think that period coming up, you know, we've obviously got, you know, another 3 weeks till we get there. So he's got more opportunities in practice and in games to do it too. But I point to that period we're talking about where they've got a lot of time to work on Michigan State. And an individual has a lot of time to work on his game, his body, all of those things. That, to me, is going to be very critical in terms of a period of development for Pierre Brooks. But he showed well today. And
yeah.
You know, those points came in handy. 5 quick points, and he didn't look afraid. Didn't look like the moment was too big for him.
And I don't know. It might just be something small, but it seemed like maybe this is the type of thing that you're talking about with him. He seems like he out of all the wings was getting the deepest in all the way into the corner, like within inches of the absolute furthest he could get into the corner when as he's running down the lane, or the sideline. And that being all the way, like as far as you can get, not 3 or 4 feet away, but all the way, opens it up just a couple feet for them, their action up top. Well, it was just something I saw. It's like, man, why don't all the wings get that far deep?
I think it's a good point, and it's something I believe Izzo touched on and we mentioned yesterday, spacing.
Yeah,
right? It has not been ideal, and that's on the point guards in part, but it's on other guys too.
For example, as you say, when the wings are running those lanes, are they spacing properly, or are they kind of drifting into areas where it makes things more congested and tougher for the offense to function? You know, mm-hmm. I think it's a good point.
Okay. Well, I mean, any final thoughts about this one, Rod?
That's a good win, man. I mean, yeah. That UConn team to me, I haven't seen everybody, but I've seen Seton Hall a bit. We obviously saw Butler. I've seen a little bit of St. John's against Indiana. Villanova is still a favorite in that league, and rightly so. But I would put UConn right behind them. That's, to me, easily an NCAA tournament team. I'd be beyond shocked if they're not a tournament team. They've got too much. I would say the one issue for them is point guard behind Cole.
Mm-hmm.
It is maybe an issue, but you look at, you know, they played, what did they play? They played eight guys today. We know they go one more deeper. They've got a 9-man rotation. They got plenty of depth, athleticism and length all day long. So I think that's going to prove to be a really nice win for Michigan State.
Yeah, definitely a quad win. Quad one for sure,
without question. Yeah, yeah. I'd be floored if it's not.
They could be a four, maybe even a three seed when it's all said and done.
To me, that's not a team that you put ceilings like that on. Now, it's also not automatic that they reach that level. They're not perfect. We saw today, you know, there are flaws there. They didn't shoot well from deep. Michigan State had something to do with that. But, you know, they didn't have them today, but they can have turnover problems. That's one thing we should mention because we talked about it as a key. MSU with only 12 turnovers in the game. UConn only had 9. But, you know, you put that into the hopper, that's pretty good, especially considering MSU had a three offensive rebound advantage. So that more or less makes it even in those two areas. But that was a big deal for MSU. Even though the second half got rough at a certain point, they did have 8 turnovers in the second half, but boy, the first half, only 4, very cleanly played.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in an up-tempo game against a tough, physical, long opponent, it just goes to show you just can't tell with MSU whether it's going to be tolerable or just insanely bad. You don't know from moment to moment.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Big win. Yeah. Make no mistake about that.
And that gives them another opportunity at Baylor for definitely a quad one game at least. And a chance to rocket up the rankings, you would think, after these two games and then a win on Baylor would put them right back into sort of the talk for a pretty big team and nationally, I would think.
Well, Baylor's ranked 6th right now, and having seen them now the last couple of days a bit, pretty much all the game today, I hate to say this because outside of Gonzaga and Purdue, I haven't seen anybody that's without flaws, you know. Mm-hmm. So can I truly say, well, they're 6th, they're overrated? I think they're a little overrated.
I don't know how much, because again, it's all relative, and there aren't a lot of teams playing perfect basketball right now. I know this much. They are not what they were last year.
Yeah.
Seen them today kind of struggle to put a VCU team that's not really a vintage VCU team. Baylor struggled to put them away. What made last year's Baylor team so great, they were a good team overall, but as I think most of our listeners probably realize, the start was that guard trio that they had,
yeah,
right?
Teague, Butler, and
those guys and Mitchell, those guys were outstanding.
Oh yeah, David
and
Mitchell.
And that's what made Baylor what they were. This group is not at that level. I saw a sign, and I'm not saying they're bad. They're far from bad, but that was a really, really exceptional group. And what I saw today was several players just making decisions that were questionable at times. I understand VCU presses and all that, but this is not a team right now that I look at and think, well, they got a great shot to repeat.
Yeah.
I don't think that. You know, they're good. They're going to be a hell of a win for Michigan State, and they're going to push MSU. That's for damn sure. But I just, even though their numbers, you know, you look at their guys and you know, Cryer was leading them in scoring coming into today. Akinjo was averaging almost 8 assists a game. Flagler is a good player, and he's coming back from last year. You know, they've got some guys, but I just don't believe in this group anywhere close to the way I believed in last year's group, and that's a difference. You know,
yeah,
their interior is still pretty good, but again, they lost guys from last year's team. Are the guys who are playing those roles now as good? I don't know if they are. It's a good team though. Make no mistake about that.
Yeah, and a balanced one.
Yes.
KenPom through what, 6 games, KenPom's got their offense at 6 and defense at 6.
Yeah.
So they're
Michigan State, I believe, defensively, are they number 1 now?
I believe they're 2.
2. Okay. And I think
2. Yeah.
2. So I think that that's going to be an interesting part of this game is Michigan State's length and how that plays defensively. Because we're 6 games in for MSU, and
mm-hmm.
they've seen a variety of types of opponents. You know, you saw Kansas, who obviously has a smaller team than we're used to, and I think that hurt MSU a little bit. Had a guy just go off and have a great night, and they've got some very, very good individual talent on that team, no question. You see a Butler team that maybe isn't as good even as people thought they might be, kind of picked in the middle of the pack of the Big East. They're not off to a great start, but that game was on the road in a very tough environment. And that's a Butler team with a lot of experience. So I still think blowing them out was a statement of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
You face Loyola, extremely disciplined team that had been shooting the lights out, and you really put a clamp down on them defensively. And then today, UConn, another team that's played very well offensively coming into today, and they had earned everything they got, and it just wasn't enough. I think we're getting to the point that you can accurately say Michigan State's defense is some level of for real. If someone wants to say, well, I don't think they're the second best defensive team in the country, okay. I'm not going to argue that point right now. But are they good? Yeah, I think they've shown enough. And I'll admit to being pleasantly surprised.
Yeah.
It was one of the first things we talked about in the season preview, right, in terms of macro kind of points. Michigan State was a bad team offensively last year, but you figured they'd be better this year just because they'd have better point guard play and maybe better shooting. And I think that's been evident. But what was quietly a problem last year and was overshadowed by the bad offense
is that they weren't anywhere close to a Michigan State standard team defensively.
Mm-hmm.
In certain individual games, they were down the stretch, but season long, they weren't anywhere close. And I didn't know, you know, they lost their best individual defender, right? They had one stopper in Aaron Henry, and he's gone. And then another guy in Josh Langford, who was reliable at least, and he's gone too. So now you're talking about throwing a freshman in Max Christie in there. You know, you don't know how Markey can hold up in terms of minutes. Can Julius Marble be any better than he's been to date? You know, all these things, very, very open questions. And they've answered all of them. I think the Kansas game was not a great performance. If you remember that, Kansas really took them off the dribble a lot. And that dribble penetration caused them problems. But other than that, this team has been rock solid defensively, and I think a big, big part of it is their length. It's not all of it, but it's a lot of it. We talk all the time about how much Bingham affects games, but maybe under-discussed is the way that having guys like Brown and Christie out there, their length on the perimeter is also impacting things. And then you add in the fact that Tyson Walker has been, I think, as advertised defensively. I think Hogard has held his own defensively when he's been in there. And we talked, you know, you mentioned it, and I think it was absolutely accurate. You look at a game like today, and Julius Marble made an impact defensively.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Malik Hall made an impact defensively late, and he's been good all year long. So, in totality, this is a really good defensive team. Baylor's a good defensive team, too. But I don't think Baylor has seen a defense like MSU's. VCU is, you know, they are what they are. They trap.
Yeah.
It's not the same thing. Possession to possession. You know, both teams, I'm not expecting, I guess I would be surprised by a really fluid, pretty game. I think both teams will try to run, much as we saw today with UConn. And so sometimes they'll get into transition, but I think both teams are going to make it difficult on the other to score. That's what I expect. I would be surprised by a game played in the 80s. Maybe it happens, but I'd be surprised. And I think that's where Michigan State can hang in there against a team like Baylor is because of the way that they're checking.
It seems like the emergence of Marcus Bingham, too, has allowed them to maybe shift things up a little bit schematically. Rather than trying to keep everything, you know, right in front of you the whole time, they're able to maybe steer people into danger more. You know, almost, you know, let people get around you to some degree on the end and then just run into a tree of hands.
Yeah, not necessarily let them get around you, but I think you had it right the first part. Steer them, lead them into spots on the floor where you think you've got it covered.
Right.
And where it's going to be tough for a guy to make a play.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's absolutely true. Absolutely true.
Well, I mean, do you want to get into some of the players here on Baylor? I guess you'd start with, well, their new point guard. He was there last year, but Akinjo.
Well, he wasn't here. He's bounced around. Akinjo started out at Georgetown, and then he transferred. I believe he played last year at Arizona.
Oh yeah, yeah. I think you're right there.
So he's on his third stop. He's a
but
guy.
But senior, 6'1", 190.
Yep. Yep. You know, people have been fans of his, and I got to be honest, I never really saw it. I don't think he was great today. I didn't look at the box score, but just kind of watching the game, I didn't think he was great. But, you know, prior to today's game, he was averaging 10 points, 7.8 assists to just 2.8 turnovers. I mean, that's a really good ratio. So he's been dynamic. And he shot okay going into today, 40% overall, 39% from three. Look, I think that even though I think he's been maybe less than the hype suggested he was over the course of his career, on the other hand, I think he's played pretty well thus far, and I think he'll pose a challenge for Michigan State. Maybe similar to what Cole did today, you know? But I think Cole's a pretty good player.
Yeah, yeah. And then they also got L.J. Cryer. He's getting 24 minutes a game. He leads them in scoring 17.8 a night, 2.8 rebounds, 2.6 assists, a steal a game, shooting 60 from the floor, 54 from three-pointer, 100% from the free throw line.
Yeah, and I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think that Cryer is a guy who's come back but is playing in a bigger role.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep, he was there
and
last
so,
year.
Again, I, the numbers are good. You know, just like the Hart with Akinjo, I just it's hard to separate them from last year's team because if I say, well, they're not up to the same level, that doesn't necessarily mean they're bad. It just means they're not at the level of a national championship group, you know? Cryer's obviously playing very well, and he's shooting the ball very, very well, which is key. So, yeah, he's going to be a handful, you know?
Yeah,
he's going to be a guy that either Brown, but he's – how tall is he? He's not a big
he's
kid.
6'1", 185.
Right. So he basically is point guard sized. So they're a little small in that starting group, and – that's where a Brown or a Christie maybe can be disruptive with their length.
Yeah.
And that's what you'd hope.
And then they got Kendall Brown, who's a freshman, 6'8", 205.
He's good.
Yeah.
He's good. I believe he was a prep school teammate of Jaden Akins last year when Jaden transferred to Sunrise.
Mm-hmm.
Kendall Brown can play. I watching him today in today's game, yeah, he didn't do anything in the first half, and then the second half, he was tough. I mean,
yeah.
really, really tough. He's shooting the hell out of the ball. He looks to me like he's tough off the dribble. And he's, unlike Cryer, he's got size. I'm pretty sure he's around 6'7", 6'8". So,
6'8", yeah.
Yeah. So he's a guy who, you know, is much like Brown and Christie. He's long, and he's going to play bigger at that spot.
Mm-hmm. And then they got the mayor, the mullet guy that we saw, 21.6 minutes a game, 11 points, 4.2 rebounds, 40% from the floor, 25% from three. But he's been better than that.
And he was better than that today. He hit some big shots.
Yeah.
It seemed like every time VCU seemed about ready to get it into a one possession kind of game, Meyer would step up and hit a three. Now he's an interesting player. You know, you don't see guys like him very often. He's not particularly physical, but he's 6'10", and as you say, he can shoot. Historically, we've seen that. We saw it in their game today. Earlier this season, he'd struggled a bit from deep, but he's a threat, no question. Just a guy that has a knack for making plays, I think.
And he's been there. He's a senior. He's been there the whole time, and he was a fairly big contributor last year.
Absolutely.
So he's
absolutely
been through it.
He's one of the key guys back because he played a big role on that team. So, you know, yeah, that experience definitely counts for something.
And then they got another big guy, Jeremy Sochan, 6'9", 230. He's a freshman. He doesn't start, but he gets a lot of minutes. Coming off the bench,
I thought he was good today. And Sochan was a guy that people may remember. There was a period where Michigan State recruited him. He played at Huntington Prep, which is AJ Hogard and Miles Bridges' old prep school. And there was a period where MSU was involved in that recruitment, and then they weren't, and he ended up at Baylor, which usually means you're not an OKG for one reason or another. But I liked him today. You know, this tournament is my first extended viewing of him, and I think he's a guy who can make plays. He looks like potentially a very good rebounder from the four. He came into today averaging almost 7 a game.
Mm-hmm.
Not yet maybe the stretch four that they envision him to be eventually, but, yeah, he's a good player. He'll be a handful.
And then at the five, they have Sochan and Mayer kind of switch at the four. Sometimes Mayer's at the three. But the center, they're usually starting Chachua. Is that how you say it?
Chamwa.
No, he's off the bench. They're starting Thamba. Flo Thamba.
But both those guys, they're similar players, and you saw it today. Thamba is scoring slightly more. At least he was coming into today. Both of them are, you know, they play the way you want a big man to play. They're both better than 60% shooters from the floor. They bring a physicality. They're longish. You know, Thamba is more of an impact guy defensively. He came into today averaging almost 1.5 blocks per game. Chamwa Chatua does not really block shots, but he's a better rebounder. He's averaging 8. He came into today, and I don't think he hurt this because he seemed to play well. He came into today averaging 8.4 rebounds a game, and that's in less than 19 minutes. That's really productive. He's their leading rebounder by a considerable margin, actually. Despite basically splitting minutes. But you can look at them as sort of the equivalent to Markey and Julius at MSU's five. They're more or less sharing that position. They're a little more evenly split than MSU is. MSU is playing Markey a little bit more than Julius. But, it's a good combination because they're both guys that are experienced. They've been through it too. You know, they played roles on last year's team.
Adam Flagler, who was with Baylor last year, 6'3", 180, shooting 52% from the floor, 28 from three.
Yeah, he hadn't shot well yet, but I think he was hurt a little bit in the preseason, so he may be shaking some of that off. I liked him last year. I thought he was a really good – he was the only – reserve that really made an impact with that guard group that they had, but he did make an impact. He was important.
43% last year from three.
Yeah, exactly. And so they would certainly expect that he will shoot better as this year goes along. But they're fortunate enough that right now, because of Cryer and Brown emerging and Akinjo transferring in, that they still have the luxury of bringing Flagler in off the bench.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a nice spot to be in.
Yeah. And then the only other guy, Dale Bonner, 6'2", 170 junior. But he only plays like a turn a game, three to 5 minutes a game.
And he's a transfer, I believe from Division II. As you say, I've got him actually playing about 13 minutes a game. He's not scoring less than 2 points a game, but he struggled from deep and really struggled overall. But, you know, you're talking about a team that it's a nine-man rotation essentially, and he's the ninth guy. So they don't need to ask a lot out of him. It's just, you know, maybe get somebody a blow. I think they feel pretty good about, you know, Cryer and Brown on the wings, Akinjo at the point, and Flagler is the primary all-purpose reserve back there. They don't need a lot out of Bonner.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, what kind of keys do you think we're looking at?
Well, look, Baylor hasn't been crazy good from three as a team, and we've mentioned some guys, primarily Meyer and Flagler, who have shot well in the past but have not shot well, at least up until today.
Mm-hmm.
I would still be worried about Baylor as a three-point team. I think that Michigan State, you know, Baylor doesn't have a lot of guys. Like, they're big kids. They were effective today, but I don't think they've got anybody – they don't have anybody the equivalent to what Sonogo was as a post threat, in my opinion. They're quite like that as a post scorer, right? So I think job one defensively is you got to hold them down from deep, and that means holding down attempts, you know, first and foremost, and just making every shot they take a difficult one. So that would be the first thing. I would say a second key is, once again, we go back to the usual – turnovers. You don't want to be making mistakes that that turn into easy baskets for Baylor. I think what gives Michigan State a legitimate chance in this game is the way they're defending. So you want to minimize the cheap points that Baylor gets. That means keep them out of transition, One good way you do that, don't give the ball away in those situations that lead to easy baskets. Rebounding, you know, this statistically, this isn't a dominant Baylor rebounding team, but I think Michigan State definitely needs to be looking at getting an edge on the glass, because I expect that, much like in this UConn game, even if MSU does a pretty good job in the turnover department holding them down, I would expect Baylor will have some kind of edge there, hopefully a small one. So that means Michigan State probably needs to, you know, do a better job than Baylor does on the glass. And, you know, VCU is a very different team than Michigan State, but one thing that has some commonality is I thought VCU really attacked the offensive glass for a lot of that game and kept balls alive and made it difficult. MSU has personnel to do that too.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be wise to see Michigan State getting some things done on the offensive boards. And then I would say one more. You know, it's been true the first two games in this tournament. Michigan State needs to shoot threes. We talked about them needing to defend threes. I think they've got to continue what they've done these last two games, getting high percentage looks and burying them. And, you know, today, 6-for-13 as a team, heck, it could have and should have been even better than that.
Yeah.
Because they had some shots. I mean, Joey Hauser, he hit a couple, but he got robbed on a couple more. You know, they had good looks. It just didn't go. This was a day that I think in terms of quality of shot that they generated and the guys taking them could have been even better than they were. It could have been a plus 50% day easily. They've got to continue that. I mean, I think, again, Baylor's a really good defensive team. So if you're MSU, you got to find ways to score, and the three is going to be an important part of that for them. No question.
Okay. Well, you know, any final thoughts heading into this championship game?
I think the biggest takeaway for me, we talked about this at the outset. You go into these things wanting to win a championship, and now they've given themselves a chance to do that. So that's great. And a win here would be big. A win over a team rated where Baylor is and with Baylor's talent and all of that, that would be quite a statement as to where Michigan State is at the moment. It would solidify some things. But on the other hand, I kind of feel I like where they're at anyway. They're a long way from perfect, but I think they're also a long way from being a finished product, which is good. So this is about development. You know, Izzo talked about one of the things he liked about this field was the variety of styles of play that you're going to see. And I think also the caliber of opposition. You know, I still maintain, I don't think I see a Final Four team in this field, but there also wasn't a soft touch. And there have been a lot of close competitive games that have been played in this thing to date, right? So that's reflective of that fact. So by winning the first two games, I think Michigan State's already made it a success, is where I land. I'm not saying, hey, whatever happens, you know, or like the line Drew Valentine had yesterday, their program, you know, he felt like their program is a long, long way past moral victories. Well, that's true for them. Where's Michigan State?
Yeah.
But at the same time, no matter what happens tomorrow, I'm going to look back at it and say, hey, they beat two pretty good teams, two teams that I expect will be in the tournament. That's meaningful on neutral floors. That's a big deal. So they've accomplished some. And here's one more thing maybe to think about. It's easy to overrate the concept of clutch, right? This is something that people who really study and believe in what we'll loosely call analytics really like to harp on, that, oh, there's no such thing as clutch. And you see that, you know, there's no difference in the value of a basket in the 39th minute of a game or the third minute of a game. Well, that's true. Clearly, mathematically, that's true. But I think today was an example. Michigan State was down 7 under 5 minutes to go, and you got a choice. You can either fold or you can continue to fight and find ways to make plays to win a game when it's all there for the taking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, The fact is, there is a different kind of pressure in that situation than there is in the fifth minute of a game. There just is. Anybody who's played a sport can tell you that.
Yeah.
Success at that time of the game is not necessarily predictive of what will happen in similar situations in the future. But I do think there is absolutely value in being able to perform in those circumstances and being able to draw on that experience as your season goes along and the impact that that can have on your confidence.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's an exaggeration. You know, I really don't. And so Michigan State, two straight days, has done the job when it mattered. You know,
yeah.
When a close game was there in the balance and you can either make plays to win or find ways to lose, they have made plays to win and against good opponents. That's big. That's a big, big positive to come out of this thing. And again, that's true no matter what happens against Baylor. But I'd sure like to see another win, and I think they're capable of getting it. I really do.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's kind of where I land. So it's been a lot of good stuff in this tournament through the first 2 days for Michigan State. No doubt about that.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll hit everyone after this game tomorrow. And until next time, the Final Four is not on the schedule.